I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 4th, and we have a lot to talk about. There's a tremendous amount of emphasis being placed on patient-centered care when it comes to treating MS or just about any other medical condition that you can think of. It seems as though the healthcare industry is learning that there's a real benefit to including the patient and even their caregiver when it comes to designing a treatment plan that's going to deliver the best outcome for that patient. And while that inclusiveness is really good news, it also carries a couple of responsibilities with it. First off, if a patient is going to be at the center of their treatment and have those kinds of conversations with their neurologist or other members of their care team, well, they have to be an informed patient. They also have to be able to follow through on their treatment plan. Now, that might mean adding exercise to their daily routine or making dietary changes. And the reality is that making changes to our health behaviors is challenging for everyone, and maybe more challenging if you're already dealing with a chronic condition like MS. My two guests are with us today to speak to these two issues that we don't always think about, but they can be difference makers when it comes to your quality of life. Health literacy expert Dr. Kalina Sanders is going to help us understand how increasing our health literacy can help produce the best treatment outcomes. And wellness coach Kate Costello is here to explain how changing your health behaviors can be a lot easier when you have someone supporting you every step of the way. But before we get to my conversations with Dr. Kalina Sanders and Kate Costello, there are a few other things that you should know about. The Canadian MS Working Group, which is made up of neurologists with the Canadian Network of MS Clinics, has updated their recommendations for diagnosing and treating MS. Now, the last set of diagnosis and treatment guidelines was released back in 2013, and since then, new diagnostic criteria have been introduced, not to mention several new disease-modifying therapies that are now available. When it comes to diagnosing MS, the newly released guidelines recommend using what's known as the 2017 McDonald criteria. The McDonald criteria has been the standard for diagnosing MS, and it was last updated by an international panel of experts in 2017. These new criteria will allow for an earlier and more accurate diagnosis of MS. The new treatment guidelines include recommending Ocrevus for the treatment of primary progressive MS, but the guidelines also contain a caution against prescribing Ocrevus for people who are less likely to benefit from the therapy, specifically people who are 55 years old and older, as well as people with significant neurological problems. The new guidelines include recommendations for treating pediatric MS, and they also recommend that neurologists encourage wellness practices, like encouraging their MS patients to stop smoking or to start exercising. Now, Canada has the highest per capita rate of MS in the world, so these guidelines have been designed to ensure that Canadians living with MS are gaining the benefit of the very latest evidence-based treatment strategies and therapies to manage MS. And if you'd like to review the new guidelines for diagnosing and treating MS in Canada, you'll find a link in today's show notes. People living with MS experience a decline in motor function, which leads to physical disability over the course of their disease. And a research team in Amsterdam has published the results of a 10-year study that show that walking declines more rapidly than hand or arm function, and that people with progressive MS demonstrated an earlier and faster decline in both mobility and hand dexterity. Now, this study followed 156 people who were newly diagnosed with MS in five different neurology clinics between 1998 and the year 2000. The median age of the participants was about 37 years old. 64.7% were women, and 82.1% were diagnosed with a relapsing form of MS. The study participants were examined and tested 7 times over the 10-year period of the study, and the study results were consistent with past research study results. So understanding this ascending order of motor function loss may help scientists understand the underlying mechanisms of MS progression and can also help rehabilitation specialists in prioritizing treatment plans for people living with MS. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. While we're talking about treating MS, it's the ideal time to remind you that the best treatment outcomes can occur when the patient is a full partner with their neurologist in designing their treatment plan. But you can't be a real part of those conversations unless you've done your homework, unless you become what I call an informed medical consumer. Healthcare professionals call that improving your health literacy. And improving your health literacy is not only personally empowering, it can deliver real-world benefits in managing your MS. I had an opportunity to discuss health literacy and its importance with health literacy expert Dr. Kalina Sanders. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Sanders and hear that conversation. Health literacy is something that patients may not spend a lot of time thinking about, but it can have a significant impact on the quality of the healthcare that each of us receives. My guest today is Dr. Kalina Sanders. Dr. Sanders is a board-certified neurologist at Baptist Health in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, where she specializes in MS, and Dr. Sanders is a health literacy expert. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Sanders.
Thank you, John.
I'm hoping you can start us off by giving us a definition of what health literacy is and why it's so important.
Yes, there are several definitions of health literacy. However, the most widely used definition is from the Institute of Medicine. They defined health literacy as the degree to which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process, and understand basic health information and services needed to make the appropriate health decisions. These include the ability to do things like understand instructions on a prescription bottle, follow appointment directions, understand what you read in a medical education brochure, being able to understand and provide consent for procedures, and really negotiating around the complex healthcare system in which we live in.
Maybe you can help us see a little bit how inadequate health literacy can impact someone who's living with MS.
Definitely. There has been a lot of research looking into the impact of health literacy on health outcomes. And we have found that those patients or people that have low health literacy are oftentimes people with chronic mental and physical health conditions, such as multiple sclerosis. Now, although the research in multiple sclerosis is limited, I think we can extrapolate what we've learned in other chronic medical conditions, such as diabetes and cancer. And we know that patients with multiple sclerosis have and whom also have low health literacy have more likelihood of having poor adherence to their medications, which may oftentimes result in more medical errors. They tend to seek and receive less preventative care. There is a higher risk for hospitalizations and emergency room visits. And then we also find that there is an ineffective management of the chronic conditions due to such things as inadequate self-care skills. And there seems to be a lack of knowledge about the connection between risky behaviors and their overall health. And then unfortunately, we can see a higher mortality rate in those who have lower health literacy. There was one particular study that looked specifically at multiple sclerosis patients looking at a self-report registry called NARCOM. And they found that although a majority of those patients had what they found to consider functional health literacy, they did find that those patients that had lower health literacy were more likely to utilize the healthcare system, such as hospitalization and emergency room visits. They also found that they were more likely to have more riskier behaviors, such as smoking and obesity.
What are some of the factors that contribute to low levels of health literacy?
So there are many factors that come into play when it comes to low health literacy. General literacy levels, such as reading skills, is a big contributor to health literacy. If you think about it, a lot that we engage with in the healthcare system is in written material. And so there are oftentimes material that is beyond the reading level of our patients, and that might contribute to their understanding of what we are wanting our patients to know. There may also be cultural and societal barriers to healthcare access as well. How do you learn to adequately maneuver around the healthcare system when there are insurance coverage issues and other cultural and societal barriers that prevent the actual engagement? So as I mentioned before, patients that have lower health literacy seek and receive less preventative care. And so part of that is actually having access to it. So there are some socioeconomic impacts that occur. And then during this time of virtual reality that we are living in now, I would have to add that computer literacy is a big part to play in having health literacy. And then for our MS patients in particular, we have to include the cognitive difficulties that come along with multiple sclerosis, which also has a major impact on health literacy levels.
We may not individually be able to fix some of the larger institutional issues that can contribute to low health literacy, but are there steps that someone can take to increase their own level of health literacy?
There definitely is. So in addition to making sure that your healthcare provider is giving you the information at a level that you understand, it is important that a person with lower health literacy ask questions. There have been several education programs over time that have existed to help us with this issue. But the one that I like the most is something called Ask Me 3. And this was really designed to promote better communication between the healthcare providers and their patients. So if your healthcare provider is not providing you the information in a way that you understand, it's important that you ask questions. And so the three main questions that I would encourage you to ask your healthcare provider is, one, what is my main problem? And make sure that they're able to provide it in terms that you can understand. The next question you should ask is, what do I need to do? And again, if you're not understanding or don't feel that you can follow their directions, ask them to clarify. And then three, I think probably the most imperative is the, why is it important for me to do this? This helps to connect the what and the why, and that ensures that you will adhere to the recommendations of your healthcare provider. So definitely don't be afraid to ask for clarification. The other thing that it is important to know is that the written materials that you receive, they really should be written at about a fifth or a sixth grade reading level. So if there are words on the pamphlets that you receive, ask questions and get clarification about what the individual words mean. And then engaging the remainder of your family so that everyone can be on the same page.
I'm glad you mentioned communication between a doctor and a patient. Shared decision-making between a doctor and patient is something that we frequently hear about. What does shared decision making look like, and how does a patient's health literacy influence their participation in shared decision making when it comes to their own treatment?
That is a very hot topic here recently. The health, as healthcare providers, we have historically felt that communication between a patient and a healthcare provider was one way. We told you exactly what we wanted you to know, and we expected you to go home and follow it. But we are learning more and more that this is really a two-way conversation, and that the input from the patient is as important as our knowledge that we can give to you. So shared decision-making is really an open communication between the healthcare provider and the patient. Now, if you can think about it, multiple sclerosis is a complex disease with still a lot of unknowns, and the treatment options are even more complex. And so as we have increased our therapeutics and the effectiveness of it, they also are balanced or come along with potential risk. So the first part of a shared decision making is to make sure that you are educated and knowledgeable about the disease, the impact of the medication, and it's not only its impact now, but also in the future. That would help that to ensure that you are making the right decision for you. The other thing that is important is to make sure that the provider is explaining things for you, and that in a way that you can follow. So the main thing with shared decision making, and I can't stress it enough, is open communication. And so being able to speak up to your healthcare provider if you feel that there are some aspects of our recommendations that is uncomfortable for you or something that you may not want to participate in. And then we can hopefully come to a decision on what's the best option for you.
Well, Dr. Kalina Sanders, thank you for all you do every day to not only improve the lives of the MS patients that you treat, but to remind all of us that being informed and being ready to communicate is the first step toward being fully engaged in our own medical treatment. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
CanDo MS is offering a two-day virtual program specifically focused on the issues faced by young adults between the ages of 21 and 45 who are living with MS, along with their support partners. The program is called Take Charge, and the two-day live interactive sessions, along with the pre-programmed learning courses, will give participants the opportunity to develop a plan to take control of their MS, to attend private coaching sessions with professional advisors and MS experts, including a physical therapist, a financial planner, and a nurse practitioner. You'll be able to learn from others through group discussions and make lifelong connections while you participate in daily happy hours and virtual yoga classes. Now, this year, CanDo MS is offering two Take Charge sessions, one taking place October 1st and 2nd, and the other October 3rd and 4th. You can apply to attend one or both of these sessions, and if you apply for both sessions, well, you'll only be selected to attend one. These sessions have limited seats, so not everyone who applies can be selected to participate. Participants are expected to fully participate during the two-day program. You'll need a webcam, a reliable internet connection with access to Zoom, and a quiet place. Some sessions will require people with MS and their support partners to be connected in separate rooms. I think this is a transformational program, and the deadline for submitting your online application is 9 a.m. Eastern Time on Monday, August 17th. Applicants will hear back on the status of their application by August 31st. If you're interested in learning more or applying to participate in the Take Charge program, you'll find a link to the online application in today's show notes. We talk a lot about MS advocacy on the podcast because I've found that there are few things more empowering than advocating on your own behalf. As an MS activist, I think it's important that our legislators and Congress understand the impact that funding MS research can have on the nearly 1 million families across the United States who are affected by MS. I think it's important that our lawmakers understand that things like the cost of prescription medications and access to quality, affordable health care are lifelines to people affected by MS. And as we've watched the horrifying impact of COVID-19 on people in nursing homes, the need for disaster preparedness laws that protect people with disabilities has been made crystal clear to the world. But that's what I think. And right now, the National MS Society is interested in what you think. The MS Society is conducting an online survey that gives you an opportunity to share your input on the Society's public policy priorities. The results of the survey will ultimately influence the policy priorities that the Society will pursue, so this is your chance to register your opinion on where and on what the National MS Society's advocacy efforts should be focused. The online survey will take you about 10 minutes to complete, and if you'd like to participate and have your voice included in this survey, you'll find a link in today's show notes. At the beginning of today's episode, I pointed out that managing MS oftentimes requires that we make changes. But changing health behaviors while managing a chronic condition like multiple sclerosis can feel overwhelming and maybe even seem impossible. That's where my guest, Kate Costello, comes in. Kate is a licensed dietitian and nutritionist and a health and wellness coach. And if you haven't thought about having a wellness coach support you in making changes to your health behavior, then I think you're going to gain a lot from my conversation with Kate. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, wellness coach Kate Costello. We're talking with licensed dietitian and nutritionist and wellness coach Kate Costello. Kate, welcome to the podcast.
John, thank you so much for having me.
I don't know how many of our listeners are familiar with what a wellness coach is or what one does, so that seems like a really good place for us to start. What does a wellness coach do?
A wellness coach is someone who invokes transformation and change in an individual seeking health coaching. Coaching is a collaborative relationship between two equals, and that's a really different angle than our typical experience with healthcare practitioners. You know, they're the expert. And in coaching, the client is the expert. It is driven by the client and what the client needs. Coaching starts with the assertion that people are, by their very nature, creative, resourceful, and whole. And they're capable. And they're capable of finding answers and choosing and taking action, learning new things, and they're capable of recovering when things don't go as planned. Coaching helps remind people of their inner light, and it helps them find it again. And coaching is not therapy. It's very different. Therapy's lens is what happened in the past and how does it affect the present and future. Coaching is all present and future focus. Certainly things about our past comes up. But what a coach would do is, how does it impact the present and the future of you achieving goals? And I think I mentioned this, but coaches are change agents. They are looking for change in clients.
So how can a wellness coach be helpful to someone who's living with MS?
That's a great question. And this is partly why I am a wellness coach, is that I have had an experience in my life that, I think that this is true of many people with MS, is that their MS impacts almost every, if not every aspect of their life, their day, their week, their year, all of their relationships. And I had a similar experience growing up of something that impacted all aspects of my life like that. And I spent many years in that experience leaning away from it versus leaning in. And that's a huge thing that I work on with people in the coaching setting, is leaning into their MS. What is this experience teaching us? What is it teaching them? Is there a possibility in it? There's certainly so much uncertainty. MS changes over time, and it can, for many people, change dramatically over time. And so is there a possibility to hold it differently, to see it differently, to engage with it differently, so that it becomes a very whole area of your life, not something that feels so out of control or that you are, you know, really just averse to. And there's certainly going to be obstacles with MS. I mean, you know, people often have physical activity or exercise goals. And so certainly a coach needs to be sensitive to someone who has MS if they have any sort of compromise of their mobility. And so coaches are not prescriptive. They're not going to give you a workout plan. What they do is help you actualize the workout plan. So actualize the goals of your physical activity. That's just an example.
Well, you mentioned goals a couple of times. How do you go about setting goals with a client?
There's a lovely dance between goals and flexibility in those goals. And, you know, there's a spectrum of people and what their needs are. Some people do really well with coaches that are very like drill sergeant-esque. Other people do well when their coach is a bit softer or more hand-holding. And so I think of myself as more of a hand-holding coach. I want people to loosen their grip on goals, because goals are not the only way to measure success or wellness or fulfillment. They're just one way to do that, just one way. And so I think if we're only focused on goals, we might miss some other really juicy areas of life. And so goals, there's many different ways that you can set goals and achieve goals. One of the methods that I use are something called SMART goals. And that's an acronym for specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And so we take a big goal and we choke it down into small, achievable parts. One of the cool things about coaching is that it connects goals and your life potential together. And that is the magic. That's the aha moment, is when you have a goal and you start achieving it, but it opens you up to your potential. And so then coaching, can you take that coaching and that potential and setting goals, you know, this is after a coaching experience, you can really apply that to so many other areas of life or other future circumstances. So it's a marriage, it's a dance between goals and potential. And again, there's just such aha in that.
You mentioned that sometimes you find a coach who is a drill sergeant type, and other times someone who's more of a supportive hand holder. How do people know what they're going to get? How do you go about finding the right wellness coach?
I think finding a coach is kind of like dating. You know, you gotta seek them out and explore, you know, their website, explore if they have testimonials. Most coaches offer a 10, 15, 20 minute session, like a free session prior to signing up with them or signing on with them. And that's a really important space for someone first to come with some idea of what they want, like where they want change in their life, but also to get the coach, because so much of what occurs in coaching is inherent in the relationship with the coach, right? That relationship is part of the therapy. It's not just you achieving goals. It's building that relationship, that trust with the coach that helps achieve the things that you want to achieve. So I think, you know, look at coaches, their credentials, the programs that they went to, and all of that should be, you know, accessible on their website. And if not in that strategy session, ask them those questions. Ask them if they have familiarity with some of the things that you're working on or with MS specifically. You know, again, it's like dating. You gotta see if they fit, if they match.
Well, I know that you do your coaching through Wildcrafted Wellness in Washington, D.C., and to make it easy for our listeners to find, I'll include a link to Wildcrafted Wellness in today's show notes. But I'm curious, does a coach have to be local, or can wellness coaching be delivered through Zoom or other digital tools?
Yeah, so I think everyone has, if they didn't already utilize some form of telehealth, they certainly are now with this pandemic. And so coaching can occur. All you need is a phone, really. I was seeing clients in person, and that's a beautiful experience, but also, you know, through Zoom or some other platform that your coach might use, and then also through phone calls.
Well, let's drill down to the details that people really need to know. How much does wellness coaching cost, and is it covered by insurance?
Yep, great. That is the question. I think part of the vetting process of finding a coach might be first taking inventory of what you can afford, and if that coach has any experience of working with insurance, or perhaps they might take an HSA card. Those are all things to ask when you are speed dating the coach in that strategy session. And so the price can vary, and insurance is dodgy at best. And so for many, it's an out-of-pocket cost. And I think, you know, it can range from $50 to well over $500 for a coaching session. And many coaches offer sliding scales. And if the coach you interview does not, perhaps that's then one of the requirements that you have of working with a health coach, is that they offer a sliding scale that fits within your budget. In my own practice, I want this to be accessible. And so I do offer sliding scales. And the way I structured my coaching is, it's 50-minute sessions once a week for 3 months. And there's a little bit of flexibility in that. But really, I try mostly to stick to that plan, because there's so much accountability that's built into that. There's so much structure, right? You signing on 3 months at once a week for 50 minutes, you really can get into some deep areas of change and of your life. And so, again, in your vetting process, ask those questions. Don't be scared to ask about finances, and you need it to work for you.
Kate Costello, thank you for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
John, thank you so, so much, and maybe again.
I hope so. That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/153. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And before we close things out, I'd like to invite you to leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS by visiting realtalkms.com/review. It will take you less than 2 minutes, and it would mean a lot to me. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified, and in some cases multiplied, the challenges of living with MS. From having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and virtual support groups literally on the fly, so that no one has to face MS alone. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions. And they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. I know that these are financially tough times for so many people, but I'm asking that, as you're able, please make a donation to support the National MS Society. To donate, just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. And you'll be able to make your donation, and I hope you'll be able to make that donation today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.